And that means that because we're in a relationship with the listener, in the not in the romantic sense, but in the
careful, Gabe.
Yeah, should I be? Should I be?
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am, just about every fortnight by Ken Holyoke in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
Not too bad, Gabe. Sitting here in the office today in studio B882, I guess.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. B882, meaning, because that's the number of hallway doors that there are on the longest hallway in Canada, right?
It's such a long hallway that it requires five letters and numbers after those letters. So I'm in part B of F. Although, as far as I understand, if I remember correctly, F is kind of like, is off limits. It's been closed off. There were labs there, and now there's just
Formula One racing.
I believe it was the previous episode that we were talking about. We referenced the speed that the DeLorean needed to reach to activate time travel. And I incorrectly cited that as 55 miles per hour. Well, folks, I'd have to talk to physicists to see if it's possible, but the hallway on the University Hall actually should accommodate the actual speed required to activate the 1.2 gigawatts of the flux capacitor, which is 88 miles per hour. And
That's
always,
2 million kilometers an hour.
Exactly. And as always, listener, we apologize and want to reiterate that we rely on facts and facts alone on the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
That's exactly right. And we're not afraid to say when we're wrong.
Exactly.
That said, Ken, we've been wrong very rarely. I think that's the second Hakuna Matata, isn't it?
I don't know if it's the second or third. I mean, we have special music for it, as you just heard, listener. And that music was provided to us by...
Music is provided by Shane Dahl.
I mean, we knew we weren't going to need to use it very much, but the
exactly.
Once in a while, we blow the dust off that. We're sponsored this week, as we are just about, every fortnight by the Association of Professional Archaeologists of New Brunswick, still no website, and the ULETH SHIRK Exchange Grant. And I'll tell you one thing, listener, ULETH and SHIRK both have websites. So the APANV will be catching up soon. And we also have a website, listener. And Ken, if the listener wanted to visit that website, where would they visit that website?
It would be newbrunswickarchaeology.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology.com.
That's right. And so, Ken, speaking of that, that website is still currently named after the current name of this podcast, which
That's
is
right.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, three words, smushed into one then later to make a website and an email address. Ken, as the listener is going to learn in a few moments on this program, we don't just talk about New Brunswick archaeology anymore. We
That's
talk
right.
about deep philosophical questions. We talk about Arizona archaeology. We talk about BC archaeology. We really talk about a wide range of things. We have a substantial food and culture beat.
Yep.
And so some people have suggested that we might want to consider expanding the name of this podcast in such a way to encapsulate the scope, the true scope of this podcast.
And that's right.
I think we've been very clear with the listener that we value what we consider to be a relationship with the listener.
Yes.
And that means that because we're in a relationship with the listener, in the, not in the romantic sense, but in the,
careful, Gabe.
Yeah. I think Nadine listens. So I am in a romantic relationship somewhat. this is like the old joke, Ken, where you go down to the student affairs office and say you'll take one, please.
Listener, this is I was just gonna say, listener, you'll realize that I'm not laughing because I don't have tenure.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is we wouldn't just steal the listeners' IP and rename this podcast. We would reimburse them. And that's so, Ken, what great prize do we have for the lucky listener who might rename the podcast this fortnight?
Well, so, Gabe, as our listeners across the continent and throughout the international VPN network recognize, we're all theoretical. It's a fact of life that our perspectives are shaped at an early age, but evolve over time. I believe it was the French monarchist François Guizot who stated that, quote, "Not to be a Republican at 20 is proof of want of heart. To be one at 30 is proof of want of head." Indeed, with the forthcoming American election that will probably determine whether or not we have a 2025 at all, you can see entrenched political opinions being shaped by age group, with fewer political bystanders later in life and greater numbers of, quote, steadfast voters in the over 50 crowd. Now, archaeology is not immune to this thinking. Some would argue that throughout the 20th century, we had three major paradigm shifts in the theoretical mode of thinking, from culture history to processualism to post-processualism.
Listener, you can't see this, but Ken has accidentally, instead of picking up his prize read, has picked up his lecture notes.
And so, Gabe, I think you and I can agree that we have fewer entrenched views than the generation that came before us. But I think that what we have that they don't is a freer spirit when it comes to permanently inking our bodies with art. Did you know that narrative research determined that nearly one third of Canadians have tattoos?
Hardly the same any number that listens to podcasts.
I know, and hardly any of that group regrets those. And so this week on the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, we're diving in with both feet and getting you inked. Yes, listener, if you are the lucky person to rename the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, we're going to invite you to get inked with your co-hosts. This is going to be a two-hour session with one of the famed artists from your choice of tattoo parlor. Of course, it has to be above board. This has to be a very clean facility. And we always want to be safe. And so we're going to ask that you prepare yourself in advance for this. And also, we want to make sure that you have a tattoo that you're going to love for the rest of your life. And so now this is not just going to be a free session.
Tattoo they love and no hepatitis. That's what we're going for.
Exactly, exactly.
And so this pain should be Courvoisier related.
So this is not just going to be a free session to get something generic. No, we want you to make a statement. We want you to see your theoretical orientation. So while Gabe is going to be adorned with a refreshingly tasteful Harris matrix of the ALDF-24 Area C site, I'll be going with a distance decay model showing the drop off of Washtenaw chert from the quarry, and it's going to be done all in red ink. And so we want you to...
Ken won't even know if he has it.
And so what we want you to do too, listener, is to bring your theoretical orientation to this conversation. So whether you're going to get V. Gordon Childe's famous culture historical time chart from Dawn of European Civilization, or emblazon William Phillips' quote, "Archaeology is anthropology or it is nothing," in Old English font on your chest, maybe you'll even go full processualist and get the characterization of a collector's subsistence settlement pattern from Binford's famous 1980 Willow Smoke and Dog's Tales paper. We want you to take a stance and speak your views on the past while getting tastefully inked and bringing archaeology and the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast with you for the rest of your life. And so, listener, whether you've got Dunnell vision or Schiffer brains, we want you to take part in this prize and rename the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
Well, Ken, that is a very exciting prize. And if the listener has the ticket to get them inked, where would they send it?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And I think if they act fast, we actually have some sort of tattoo convention here in Fredericton this month, I believe.
Oh, I think there's actually one here in Lethbridge. Carolyn was recently advised by a tattoo artist to do not get a tattoo at these events.
And why is that?
I think there's issues of sanitization and also issues with the people that go to these events or that are inking at these events are perhaps not the tattoo artist that you want to choose.
Right. Yeah. Inkers, not thinkers, might be what you're...
That's a good... Yeah.
So we should also, for practice, though, we should see if we can find podcast temporary tattoos.
Oh, that would be fun. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it would be. My kids love those. Anytime there's some pronghorns ones available, I bring them home.
Fantastic. Or maybe for our next our next prize for the whatever list, 20,000, I guess we're hurtling towards. Will that be the next big hurdle?
What is it?
For our next big listener hurdle, you know, be the 20,000th listener.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that could be. Maybe we'll get a special custom 20K NB Arc Pod temporary tattoo.
Well, Ken, we've got a very exciting episode coming up.
We do.
We're sort of going to talk about the Holt Point site a little bit.
We are, but we're going to check the mailbag first, Gabe.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I got so excited by getting inked up that I lost track here. So, Ken, this is what I would ordinarily say now. When the enter that mailbag, what's in it?
So we have actually, to tell you the truth, I don't think we have any new mail.
See, I knew that. That's why I was skipping over it. I didn't want to draw attention to that.
We did get we're getting some new weird emails, and I'm not sure what's motivating this. This one's titled Unlock the Secrets of Prophecy. And it looks to be
They must think you do prophecy instead of being a professor.
Yeah. Oh. This is recommending that we purchase 7 letters detailing the prophetic framework of the return of Christ. So if you're looking for your next read about the end of the known world, there you go. Yeah, so actually we're getting a whole series of vaguely Christian themed or biblical themed ebooks that I think they want us to read.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's probably not very interesting, actually. E-book genre has never been one that really left off the shelves at me.
Yeah. So no, I think we are tapped out of the mailbag. So other than Podcorn and I'm not sure how we got into this, but whatever the service is that's recommending, the algorithm has decided that we're in that framework. So, listener, we always love getting your mail. NewBrunswickArchaeology@gmail.com. New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. Please feel free to reach out anytime, and we'll read your letter on the show.
That's right. We'll probably read your letter on the show. Well, at least start to.
Yes.
Yes. We try to avoid, as you know, putting the Sioux in issues on this program. All right, Ken. So as I was saying, we've got a very exciting show coming up, and maybe the listeners should stick around if they want to learn more about New Brunswick archaeology in the 1980s and the Holt's Point site.
Yeah, yeah. Enjoy, listener. Great interview with Dimity, and we'll check in with you here after the show.
Today we're joined by Dimity Hammond, who's currently on the board of directors of the Tubac Historical Society, where she's also a site steward for a site owned by the Archaeological Conservancy. Prior to that, she worked in archaeology, social work, musical festival management, and managing an agricultural association. However, in 1984, she completed what I believe was the first anthropological archaeology master's at the University of New Brunswick. Her thesis was about the Holt's Point site in New Brunswick's Quaddy region, which is known, among other things, for a collection of incised stone pebbles that are curated at the Robert S. Peabody Institute in Andover, Massachusetts. We're thrilled that she can join us today and let us know a little bit about her time in New Brunswick archaeology and her career since then. Welcome to the show, Dimity.
Yeah, welcome, Dimity.
Thank you. Thank you.
We were very excited when you wrote in, because Ken and I were both familiar with your thesis, and so that was very excited to kind of meet you in this way. So thank you very much for joining us.
Well, I'm amazed that anybody was familiar with my thesis. And I'm very pleased. Thank you.
Yeah. I guess maybe we could just start by asking how you came to be doing your undergraduate and graduate degrees at UNB.
Well, because we lived there, and I did my thesis sort of in my mid-30s. I went past school in my mid-30s. And so I was there at UNB and had been working in Fredericton, working with the planning department, running a couple of programs there, and just said, I'm just going to go back to school and finish. So that's how I got there and doing that. And of course, at that point, I'm going to correct you. There was one other person before me, and that was Dave Burley.
Oh, okay.
At SFU. Maybe he's retired now. I don't know.
I actually don't think he is. Or he seems, I think he's at least still active. Maybe he's emeritus at SFU. I'll have to check that, but yeah.
Yeah, he got into doing Oceana stuff. But anyway, so that's, I just decided that I was going to go back to school. My kids were old enough that I could do that. So that's how that happened.
And so had you done an undergrad in anthropology at UNB and you were kind of interested in continuing with archaeology, like archaeology had always kind of been a passion, or was it something that, you know, Chris was affiliated with the anthropology department at this point and you were able to kind of take on an archaeology degree?
No, I had done a couple of years at University of Arizona.
Oh, okay.
And concentrated on archaeology and then ended up not being able to finish. So when I got up to Fredericton, I said, well, I'm going to finish my degree, and still focused on archaeology, and then decided I would try to do my graduate work in archaeology, and which was not particularly easy, because even with Chris there, I was on my own, really.
Yeah.
So could you tell us a little bit about that, actually? So you worked with Chris Turnbull, who is the provincial archaeologist. But as you mentioned, you were sort of on your own here. So what was the department like when you were doing your thesis and your undergraduate work?
Well, undergraduate work was normal undergraduate work. You know, I had to finish all the things that I hadn't done, because at U of A here, I really concentrated on doing just archaeology, because I knew that my family would say, that's enough, too much money, you know. So I had to finish all the other things. And then when I started my thesis, I was really very much on my own. Chris was there. He was busy. He was doing stuff. And when I decided to go to Holt's Point, and that was suggested to me that would be a good place to go, then, of course, I got involved with Scotty McNeish. And he was wonderful and very helpful and gave me a lot of time. And David Keeneside, who was the archaeologist at the Geological Survey Canada. And Chris was very tied up with trying to do what he needed.
Yeah. So I guess I hadn't realized that Scotty McNeish had worked in the Maritimes.
He didn't. It was because he was running the museum at Andover.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Yeah.
So
gotcha.
He was in charge of the artifacts and everything there. So that's why I ended up working with him.
Excellent.
The wounds and everything, you know.
So you said that I guess Chris Turnbull recommended Holt's Point to you as a project. Could you tell us a little bit about your work at Holt's Point and why Chris thought that was a interesting project and what you got out of it?
I have no idea why Chris thought that would be an interesting project, but it was really fun, and again, completely on my own. And I sort of went down. He said, go down there and meet the owner. And so, you know, I get into my Arco clothes and hat, and off I went, knocked on the door at this beautiful house down there at Holt's Point, this gorgeous house. And Chris had said, I think the guy is the conductor of an orchestra or something like that, you know? And so I knock on the door, and I've got my maps and I've got my stuff. And this guy who looked like Leonard Bernstein, I mean, you know, with his hair, and he opens the door with his baton in one hand and a score in the other, and looked at me and said, I've always wanted to be an archaeologist. We know that those words, you know. And I said, oh, I always wanted to be a conductor, and literally we exchanged. I gave him my map. He gave me the baton and the score, and we became really good friends.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It was wonderful.
That's great.
And he's the one who videotaped my thesis.
Okay. So you'll recognize that Gabe actually is in the Red Barn that you would have spent some time in at the at UNB. The office that he occupied. Yeah.
Oh, I was relegated to the basement.
Okay. It still leaks.
All in the bones.
Yeah.
And I had my office down there next to the coffee maker, which I was in charge of, and had all of my little pieces of pottery. And nobody ever came down there because why would they? You know, nobody really, other than, well, Gabe, are you familiar? You wouldn't have known him, but by reputation, Charlie Ackerman.
I've heard the name, yeah.
Yeah, well, he was quite the character there, and I was his TA. And once in a while, he would sort of toddle down the stairs and have a little visit. But other than that, no, I was left alone. Nobody wanted to pay any attention.
Had Gabe not been there, this kind of would have been our, had we not started at the same time for our graduate experience, we would have been in the basement of a building that's called Enterprise now, but it is basically in the middle of nowhere on campus, in a basement that that leaks, and there's a nuclear research facility upstairs from it, or used to be, and so every once in a while, this like loud buzzer would go off, and so you'd be there at like 10 o'clock at night, like, you know, your graduate student in a dark building, and this alarm would go off. And you'd be worried, like, have I just been irradiated by some kind of something that's going on?
And where was that?
So that's at UNB. So one of the things that I thought was interesting about your thesis experience is that you wrote to us that, and something our listeners might not realize is that you did your thesis at a time before we had a supercomputer basically carrying around in our pocket. And going through your thesis, you refer to it as the computer, and that that this was one of the first theses, at least in archaeology, that had been done at UNB using digital methods. And so can you tell us a little bit about the process and sort of how that changed what you were able to do with the data set from Holt's Point, basically?
Sure. So at that time, and I can't remember what building it was in, but in some building at UNB was the mainframe computer. And we were just one step beyond using the cards that you put in, which you guys wouldn't even have any idea about. But you had to work on that mainframe. I, at that point, was certainly not a computer geek, but I think it was Scotty who said to me, and Scotty was starting to get into computers, and he said, well, why don't you use a computer? And I'm like, I don't know about that, you know. But anyway, I did. Nobody else, certainly in the anthropology department, had a clue about using computers. Nothing. I mean, they had no idea in the world. And I did have to learn Fortran.
Oh.
Which was absolutely terrifying. And going up the hill, I lived on St. John Street at 8 o'clock in the morning in the summer, and learning Fortran was awful. It was awful. Anyway, so that computer process to me was like gambling. You know, you would go in, and if it worked, you didn't want to leave. And if it didn't work, then you had to stay until you made it work. And nobody understood a thing. I mean, I just went through my thesis, read through it again. And thank you for getting it for me. That was fun. Anyway, there was stuff using, I guess it was SAS the data, some program that I was just, there was just stuff coming out of it. I had really no idea what it was all about, and neither did anyone else in the department, you know. But what it did was it meant that I didn't have to have it typed.
Right.
And every time I had a correction, which was coming from everywhere, coming mostly from David and Scotty, I didn't have to retype the whole thing. And the graduate supervisor, advisor there at the department, he couldn't figure that out either. He couldn't, he said, well, you have to change this or change that. And the next day I'd come in with it changed. And he'd go, well, did you stay up all night? You know, it was sort of fun, actually. It was a good sport, really.
That's fantastic.
Because I was sort of blown away. Like there's even a figure in here where it looks like you used the software or the supercomputer to draw the schematic, like the site plan, using like an alphanumeric dashing system. I kind of can't wrap my head around how.
Neither could I. Really.
Did you, I'm curious, did you continue to be particularly interested in computers? I mean, you said you learned how to code in Fortran. Was that a beginning of a passion or no?
I love computers. I love everything about computers. I'm the techie for everybody all around. And I had to teach myself as I went through all of the different things I did in my life. I always had to teach myself the latest and really had fun doing that. I am now an Apple user. Forget about Microsoft, but anyway.
And what's interesting too, so you said you had to learn Fortran in order to do this kind of basic data entry. In kind of the contemporary grad setting, one of the things that changed when I was doing my PhD was that coding language. So like R is a programming language. I guess it's not new, but it's a programming language that a lot of paleoanthropologists and archaeologists use for managing big data sets. And apparently now, this changed while I was at U of T, was that your language requirement could now be a programming language because they become so important for integrating with archaeology, like Python for GIS mapping and all this other stuff. So you were leading the charge by learning. And I also suspect if anybody in our listenership is a computer whiz, you've got some street cred by knowing Fortran. I suspect that's probably like old school. If you're a computer techie.
I never used it again. And when I say I love computers, I love computers like what I'm using now. I don't program or do anything like that.
You're not using one that takes up an entire room.
Absolutely not.
So when you're working on Holt's Point, I think the thing that most people think about when they think about that site is the pebbles, right? They're really interesting incised pebbles. Could you tell us a little bit about your work with the pebbles, and was that here at UNB or did you go down to Andover? What did you learn about them?
Well, because they were at Andover, I went down to Andover and really went through them there with Scotty. It's really hard for me to remember, but I think that I found a couple when I was doing a little bit of excavation. I didn't do a lot there, but I think I found a couple more. They were, and still are, such a mystery. I pulled them up just now, was looking at them, and I'm thinking, gee, I need to go back and look at all of that stuff again. We never figured them out, ever. And the interesting thing was Bill Fitzhugh, who's still at Smithsonian. When we moved to British Columbia, I was working in a small museum running a site there, and way up in the attic of this old museum. I mean, the fourth floor, middle of nowhere as usual, you know, where nobody wanted to have anything to do with what I was doing. And this docent comes up the stairs, you know, an old lady, and she says, "You have a phone call from some guy named Fitzhugh from the Smithsonian." And I was like, oh, my God. Anyway, he was doing some work on some incised stones in Labrador, I believe, but maybe not. Maybe it was in the Yukon. And so he called because he was working on a paper, and he wanted to talk to me about what I had found. And again, I ran into him often other times, and we talked about these stones and tried to figure out what they were.
Yeah. I think that's the Nuliak pendants paper, right? I think is the, must have been the paper that came out of that.
We can
drop that in the show notes too, listeners, so that way you can learn more about this. They really are fascinating.
I don't know whether anybody has ever figured them out, really.
No, I don't think so. And I've seen some of them in person recently, because I was sort of thinking about that, because I've done some work down at the Andover and was looking at them, and they're really incredible.
Yeah.
And so could you describe them a little bit for the listeners?
Yeah, sure. The design on them, on most of them, is a central arc, and then with little triangles coming off of them and in the interior of them. There, it might be worth it in the show notes and I think it's page 180 on the thesis, at least the printout. And not all of them were completely finished, but you could see that basic design was the one that was being used all the time. And there was one place when I was just looking over it that they were sort of in a corner of the unit, and there was a rock, and a couple of them were leaning up against the rock, and there were a couple of pieces of ceramics around them, and they're pretty late. They're not early. They're pretty late period. But, you know, whether they were like a pocket fetish or something ceremonial, of course, you always have to say that, you know. But, or, you know, who knows, a toy? Maybe it was a game. I don't know. Maybe a game of some sort, but.
Yeah, and you draw attention to like the hashing patterns. Some of these are reminiscent of like the ground slate bayonets from Cow Point. You know, there's a site that I was looking at from the Tobique River in northern New Brunswick, where there's a groundstone implement that has this like cross hatching on one surface. Very similar kind of geometric designs. They're not as like the U-shaped design that you see on several of the stones there. I haven't seen repeated elsewhere, but yeah, totally fascinating. And it's I think without question the densest concentration of mobiliary art in the Maritimes, basically, right? And so it's totally cool. And you know, one of these things that you would think that in the intervening period we would have found other examples of it, eh?
I know, it was strange. And I'm sure you asked why Chris sent me there. I'm sure that's why, you know, right? Because he wanted to find out a little bit more about them.
Yeah. And we should say it's a middle and late ceramic site, right? Middle and late woodland?
Yep.
Yeah, so, for the most part. Yeah.
Cool.
And so you talked about in the process of getting your phone call from Bill Fitzhugh that sort of your career following archaeology in the Maritimes, you've served in a number of different capacities at different museums. And so you've taken your role as an archaeologist and turned it into a career with sort of many different facets. And currently you're stationed at you're the vice president of a historical society that manages an archaeological site as well.
Right, right. And that was fun. And the, by the way, when I was out in British Columbia, I had a great site. There was a midden, very large midden, right near the ferry terminal that goes over to Vancouver Island. And it was I had three years of federal government funding, and we opened it up to the public, and it was really a fun site.
Which site was it?
Whalen Farm.
Okay. My supervisor is a West Coast guy, my PhD supervisor. So I'll ask him if he's ever visited the Whalen Farm Museum.
Well, it was a museum in Delta.
In Delta, okay.
That I ran it out of. But at that time, you could get good federal funding, and I had students. And the SFU boys were a little jealous because they didn't give me as much money as I got.
Yeah. And this is also a PSA to anybody listening from in the federal government that we need that kind of federal fund to get pumped back into heritage. So for these sorts of initiatives, yeah.
And so what I'm doing here is it's a little 10-acre site that was the living quarters for the military at a fort here that was a Spanish fort. And the living area for the soldiers and their wives was basically just like any plaza in Spain. It had any pueblo, any village, and it had a plaza. It had the houses around the plaza. It had an acequia, and an acequia is an irrigation system that you find in the desert. So it had water. We have a river here, and it brought they brought water up even prehistorically for a long period of time. They brought water up through these acequias. And so it really was a little village. There, it was dug. You've got kachinas.
I do, yeah. Actually, there, my grandparents collected them in the Southwest. So my mom grew up in California, and they spent a lot of time in the Southwest. So there's a whole collection of kachinas from Arizona. Actually, I think for the most part,
they're very cool. Yeah, they're Hopi. Anyway, so this site was very poorly dug and with very poor field notes in the late 90s. And so I am now, you know, with this stack of field notes like this, trying to go through them and figure it out. And we're not going to dig yet. We're going to just open it. It had been open to the public. Somebody was taking tours and saying, I took one of them once. And he's a great guy, very knowledgeable, not an archaeologist. But the tours were sort of like, oh, look over there. And that was such and such a thing. Well, you know, I could look at it and say maybe it was a house at some point or mountain, of course, all adobe. So there's nothing left. And so when we open it up, I'll run it a little bit differently. And fortunately, I had the experience of the dig in the big dig at Whalen Farm with having things open to the public, which is really, that's what I like doing. I want people to be able to come on the site and see what happened there.
Yeah, yeah, that's fantastic.
And maybe, Dimity, if we could get, if you have some, like a link to that, we can put it in the show notes. So if people are in Arizona, it's a great place for Fredericktonians to escape to in the late winter, as you know.
Well, it's not open yet. Won't be open until January.
Okay.
Well, there's rumor that we're getting a direct Lethbridge to Arizona flight. I don't know where in Arizona, but if that's the case, then we'll be making our way down to somewhere warm.
Bring your stuff with you. I'd love to have some help. I've got a lot of people in town. Actually, this is a town. It's a tiny village. And we have a lot of people that are going to be working, clearing it. Right now, it's filled with rattlesnakes and other things that you don't want to be walking into. But we'll get it cleared up.
That's great. Awesome. And what part of Arizona is it in? Maybe
it is south, about 40 minutes south of Tucson.
Okay.
And about 20 minutes from the border. It's a little tiny town called Tubac, which was the first European village in what became Arizona. It's also very near where I worked on this. I went out for a year during COVID in the desert at looking for where Coronado crossed.
Oh, wow.
In the United States. And we actually found that. I was only a digger. It was great. I didn't have to do anything except just what I was told. But anyway, that was really fun because I've never dug in the desert before. That was a whole different experience. No levels. We were using metal detectors, which I had never done before. So that was really fun. That was my COVID year.
Very cool. Yeah. Yeah. I teach an archaeology of contacts course, and we talk about the Southwest and Spanish presence there. And so I think that it'll be important to include some information about this here and the next time I teach it next fall.
Yeah, I can email you a link to some of the reports from the site.
Awesome.
The conclusions that the archaeologist who ran it made are, I believe, a little fanciful, but and I can send you some other information on it.
Okay,
that'd be great, Ken. I think we're also going to have to add a trip to Tucson to our shirt grant here.
I think that's in order. Yeah,
I think that's what we've learned.
Yeah, especially since we can do New Brunswick archaeology connections.
Yeah.
Please do. It would be so much fun to have you guys come down. And by mid-November, at least I'll have a path through the site.
There you go. Yeah. I think my wife has always wanted me to find somewhere more exotic to work alongside the Maritimes. So this might be an excuse for...
Really?
She doesn't mean exotic as much as she means warmer, I think. That's
yes,
what it is,
yeah,
right, Ken?
Yeah,
it's the Fredericton to Alberta. Yeah. Well, that's great. And so I guess we really appreciate you coming on with us, and we're mindful of your time here, but we wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about if there were other kind of archaeological adventures you'd had in New Brunswick or what you remember about New Brunswick archaeology from your time here or anything like that.
You had hinted at a really funny story about your defense.
Oh, the defense. Well, that was quick, but the defense, I really don't think Chris was there, and I think he was someplace else. And so I was there with all anthropologists who knew nothing about archaeology, and David wasn't there, and Scotty wasn't there. So there I was, the conductor who owned the site at Holt's Point decided he was going to come up and videotape it. So he comes in, and I tell you, this guy was magnificent. You know, he just was just there. You know, when he comes in, sets up the video camera, all of the profs are like, you know, prepping themselves up and puffing up and all the rest of it. And then they had to actually ask what they thought was intelligent questions. And so Charlie Ackerman, who was a really funny little guy who taught Anthro 101, and he would have tons of students because he was so funny and so good. Anyway, he said, okay, Dim, he said, so you start digging the hole and then you keep digging. And when you get the hole dug down, how do you get out? I mean, these are the kinds of questions. And Lewis was videotaping it, and they're trying to think of intelligent things. And anyway, it was great sport. It really was. It was great fun. We all drank champagne afterwards. But the other site that I will tell you about is Partridge Island, which asked Dave Black about Partridge Island sometime. So we were camped on Deer Island. Chris, and by the way, there were no private companies at that point. So everything was going through the province. So we had these moldy tents that Chris had found from World War II, I swear. And David was the only guy on the site, and he had his own tent. But he, when he arrived, he found a dolphin that he put into a black plastic bag to rot in front of his tent. So nobody ever wanted to go anywhere near the tent. We had a mess tent that was, again, one of these horrible, moldy old tents. And Chris gave us a couple of tables to put in there. And we had a picnic bench. It rained all the time. Chris would arrive every once in a while with some food, tin cans, and Tang. And then he gave us a boat to go out to Partridge Island, which was down in the Bay of Fundy. And it was leaky. So you had to take all of your stuff out there. It was when people say, oh, I really always wanted to be an archaeologist, I think about, oh, no, you don't. The mosquitoes and black flies, you can imagine. It rained all the time. It was freezing at night. So we're all running around in toques and you know, sleeping bags. I brought a cot so I wouldn't have to sleep on the ground. Everybody else was sleeping on the ground in these molded tents. We had terrible food. There was a bakery on Deer Island. When we came back to the camp, we would stop at the bakery and we would get pies. And we would just eat them with our hands. I mean, it was so uncivilized. And I was the only one with a car. And I would go home every weekend to see my kids and my husband, who brought me into the house. You know, they said, just walk straight ahead, go to the shower. Don't stop. And I also brought a bottle of wine and a wine glass and said, I'm going to be somewhat civilized in this place. It was something else, really, I tell you.
I mean, so this is why you live somewhere very dry now. Is this the
exactly. Yeah. I mean, that was quite an experience. It really was. And then the next year we dug at the Lieutenant Governor's house there in Fredericton.
Okay, yeah.
That was so civilized. I mean, we could go home at night and, yeah, that was fun.
Very cool. Dimity, this has been a lot of fun. I feel like we might have to get you on again just to, like, keep talking stories Not that I envy the moldy tents, but hearing about this stuff is always kind of, it's also a good reminder for any of the students who we take out in the field these days and that roughing it today is nothing on the scale of roughing it back in the previous generation. So
absolutely not. You know, it was quite an experience. My husband came down one night and it was pouring rain. And he came down and he looked around the campsite. He said, oh, my God, you live here? And then he said, well, don't you start fires? And I looked at him and I said, no, we don't start fires. It's too wet. You can't think about it. And he tried to start a fire and, you know, show people that you could have a fire. Well, we didn't care. I mean, we were such zombies at that point that we didn't care. It was fun. There are other Partridge Island, Deer Island stories for sure.
Well, that might have to be a great sights episode.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get you and Dave, get two perspectives on it from Dave and from you. But, see if the stories link up at all, you know, and he can tell us about this dolphin that that was being decomposed in his sharing the tent with. So.
His roommate. Dimity, we really appreciate you coming on to talk with us. And it's been very nice to get to know you through this. I think Ken maybe mentioned, but we were really thrilled when we got your email. And as you know, we don't check the mail before we get on. So as that was happening, we were very excited to meet you because we'd read your thesis and had never met you. So yep. We really appreciate it.
It was so much fun for me to hear, they're reading my letter. This is so cool, guys. And, you know, and then, of course, I followed you around like the Rude 11 podcast was so much fun for me. It really was great.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much. And so we should do this again. Maybe we'll do a Partridge Island, Deer Island, Great Sights in a little bit. I think that would be good.
Yeah, I think that'd be a great idea. And hopefully we all get to, we get to go down to Arizona and see this site and do some, we'll be the Southwest Archaeology Podcast for a day or two.
Wouldn't that be fun? Guys.
It would be a treat.
It's been
okay.
So much fun meeting you.
Yeah. Really. Thank you so much, Dimity.
Thank you so much, Dimity.
Have a great day.
Okay.
All right, Ken. Well, that was a fun interview, and I think now it's time for Hit Pieces.
I do believe it is time for Hit Pieces.
We've got a couple of exciting Hit Pieces tonight. And I'm going to start off here with there's a new Tappanadney biography out. And it's by Ted. Do you know how you say his last name?
Is it I think
Ted
it's Benny.
Bain? Benny.
I think it's Benny.
Great. Ted Benny and James Wheaton. And the listener may be familiar with some of their other work on Tappanadney. They were involved in publishing his journals. And the biography here is called Tappanadney, From Birchbark Canoes to Indigenous Rights. And that is a joint effort on the part of Goose Lane Press and of Chapel Street Editions. And I should say it was available at Westminster Books, at least as of last weekend, which is where I picked up my copy, if you want to support a local bookseller. And so both of the way this book came to be is kind of interesting. Actually, unfortunately, both of the authors are deceased. So it became this major effort on the part of both of those presses and a number of collaborators, including people like the late Nick Smith, like Keith Helmuth at Chapel Street Editions. And reading from the preface here by Keith Helmuth, I think sort of summarizes it better than I could. It mentions that Adney is primarily known for birchbark canoes, but then, quote, that is only part of the Adney story. He was also the researcher and activist who in 1947 presented a legal case in a Canadian court for indigenous rights to land and resources based on the Peace and Friendship Treaty of 1725. Adney lost his case, but a later discovery and subsequent court decisions have confirmed that he was right. The Wasagoi did indeed have both treaty and Aboriginal rights to hunt, fish, and access forest resources. So
important in the contemporary context as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I've only read the first 10 or 15 pages, started it last night, but it seems to be excellent. So I'm looking forward to returning to that this evening.
Yeah, and Gabe alerted me to the fact that the book was actually out, so I have ordered my copy, and it should arrive here sometime soon.
That's great.
So our second hit piece today is, or this fortnight, is from Claude Chapdelaine. This is a 2024 article called Late Pleistocene, Early Holocene, Shoulderless Stemmed Points, A Far Northeast Perspective, and this is in Paleoamerica. His latest entry.
Make a great tattoo for the lucky listener.
Exactly. Yeah. There's another one of your ways that you could lifetime emblazon yourself with some archaeology. And so we've got a note here. So basically what this article is looking at is for the listener to recap the late Paleo-Indian period. So beginning sometime after about 12,400-ish years ago, and certainly by about 11,600 or 700 when we had the onset of the Holocene, you have some major changes in Paleo-Indian
projectile point forms. And so you have a shift from fluted points to unfluted points. In some parts of North America, so where I work out here in Lethbridge, and in the plains, you have what are shouldered or stemmed points. So these are, they have kind of incipient shoulders. Some of them are called like agate basin. Some are called Alberta points. And then you, on the East Coast, you tend to have these unstemmed versions that are tend to be elongated, and kind of a really great example of these are the St. Anne Varney type. So what Chapdelaine is doing in this article is first kind of looking at the patterning, so sort of some new data on old stuff. He's bringing a bunch of literature that he has published in French into the English literature, and he kind of does this overview of looking at whether or not there is any kind of chronological relationship between the shouldered and unstemmed late paleo points throughout the far Northeast. And as Gabe pointed out while we were talking just before getting back on the show here, was that the Maritimes is glaringly absent from the table on page 4 of this article, that it cuts off in Maine with the Varney Farm famous stemmed points, or very elongated lanceolate points. And so this is kind of interesting because what it looks like is, you know, at this time period is that you have a major technological change going on with major environmental change. There's this sort of wholesale abandonment of fluting as a technique used on projectile points. And what Chapdelaine kind of comes down on is that it's not totally resolved whether or not there's a chronological relationship, but increasingly it does look like you have these shouldered stemmed points sort of predating a lot of the unstemmed lanceolate points, extending into, the first time I've seen this, the late Paleo-Indian, between about 10,000 and 9,000 years ago. And so...
Final Paleo-Indian.
And so you've heard us probably cite several times one of our favorite terminologies, aggressively basally thinned points. And those fall into what I think would probably be comfortable in the late Paleo-Indian in this region. And so maybe that's why they're a little bit harder to identify, because they don't follow kind of the same form.
Yeah. I always find these, when I squint at these pictures of lanceolate point technology, I find it very difficult to recognize the patterns in them. So kudos to these people that are doing this. And it involves some pretty minute changes in lithic technology. You know, people have done debitage analysis on this period and stuff too. We should get Claude and maybe Nathaniel Kitchell on to talk about this stuff. They're both doing a lot of late paleo research, and it'd be interesting to know what the kind of state of the state is there.
Yeah. The other thing too is I'd like to ask Claude how he has such absolutely beautiful artifact plates all the time, and like what his camera settings are. Like he is a masterclass in plates, like artifact plates.
Yeah, well, they'll look even better as a tattoo.
Exactly. Yeah. So whether you're shouldered or unstemmed, folks, you too could be a late paleo tattoo person.
You get a giant one where it actually expands over your shoulders. That's the
exactly.
Well, Ken, I think we've done it. I think we've reached the end of another podcast.
I think we have reached the end of another podcast. Yep. And
not even too jarring this time.
No, it was barely even noticeable.
Yeah, absolutely. I think got what, maybe 45 minutes of time travel.
If that.
Yeah, I just heard the wind whistling past my headphones, and then here I was.
Yeah. No wind here today, but it was 100 kilometers an hour on Friday afternoon.
Whoa. That's same speed they're doing Formula One racing in your hallway.
Exactly. Yeah. We almost had 1.2 gigawatts of power generated here at the coulee.
All right. Well, Ken, I guess I'll talk to you soon. Listener, we'll talk to you soon.
And we'll see you next fortnight.
That's right. Take care, listener.